Lynn Truss describes herself as a punctuation vigilante, and that might sound like just the kind of person you'd like to avoid. But her book, which promises a zero-tolerance approach to punctuation, became a surprise bestseller in England. It was just published in the States, and this week it's number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list. The book was an outgrowth of a BBC radio series she did on punctuation. She's also worked as a literary editor and TV columnist for the Times of London. She now reviews books for the Sunday Times of London. Her book about punctuation is called Eats, Shoots, and Leaves. Why do you care so passionately about punctuation?
Well, I think I've always cared about clarity as a writer. I've always been... I've written for many years, and I was an editor on newspapers and magazines before that. And so my whole life really has been about trying to make the words on the page do what the writer, or I as the writer, intended. And punctuation is such a big part of that. It's part of the printing tradition. It's not so important in the electronic technologies. But as far as print on the page is concerned, putting that comma in the right place is terribly important. And I notice as a reader, I always read things with a pencil in my hand. I take out bad punctuation. I put in what I consider to be the right semicolon. It's just such a terribly important thing that communication is always as clear as it can be.
Do you repunctuate things that have already been published that you're reading?
Yeah, I do. As a book reviewer, usually, and then I struggle with whether or not to mention in the book review that I thought that the punctuation was bad. And a couple of years ago, I reviewed a book that had so few commas in it, and in the review, the woman had written quite a lot about her divorce, and I said, oh, obviously the husband got custody of the commas.
Is there a good example that you could use on radio of how the wrong punctuation totally changes the meaning of the sentence?
Well, there's a nice one that's quite well known, which is a set of words which is a woman without her man is nothing. If you just have that with no punctuation at all, I think people probably would all say, how profound, without really bothering to see whether they've read the same thing. Apparently, if you put this up on a blackboard and ask women to punctuate it, they will punctuate it differently from men. Men will put a woman, comma, without her man, comma, is nothing. A woman, on the other hand, will probably say a woman, colon, without her, comma, man is nothing. So, you know, even with the words in the right order, you really do need that helpful punctuation.
Let's talk a little bit about the comma. Do you think that any guidelines about the comma have changed since you were in school and beginning to learn punctuation?
I know that personally I use fewer commas than I ever used to. I think there is just a general drift towards fewer. I will often not always put them both, you know, around a subordinate clause if I think that the sense is okay without. One of the things that writers and editors, everyone knows, is that the conflict you can have with a copy editor over how many commas to have, it's you can never guard against it. People just have very, very different feelings about how many commas to have. I think broadcasters and actors like to have lots of commas because they need to have the guidance about breathing.
Exactly. I find I punctuate differently for the radio than I do if I'm actually writing something, because on the radio, like you said, I'm putting in pauses. I'm putting in like stage directions about where to take a breath, where to pause or hesitate, whereas on the page, it's different.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. The origins of punctuation, I mean, are the origins of writing.
It's not completely different. I don't want to overstate that.
No, I'm sure. But the origins of punctuation, you know, are from, you know, in the origins of writing. Before printing, writing was to be read aloud. It wasn't for silent reading on your own. So it was for the head monk or whatever was going to read from a manuscript of the Bible. And so the marks were in there to indicate to him, like musical notation, where to pause and inflect and so on. With printing and the rise of silent reading, you have a different function for punctuation, which is mainly to illuminate the grammar. And those things are always slightly in conflict, I think, especially with commas.
Well, one of the things you bring up here is that although there are rules of punctuation, there are disagreements about those rules, and really educated writers will disagree. A writer will disagree, an author will disagree with the editor about where a comma should go or isn't necessary. So that makes it kind of interesting, but it also makes it very imprecise. People think that punctuation is right or wrong, and there's a whole kind of gray area in between.
Well, I think that's it. I mean, I wrote about, you know, I called it the zero tolerance approach. The only thing I'm really zero tolerance about is apostrophes, that putting apostrophes in before an S in a plural, in the plural of lemons or something. That's definitely wrong. Using a singular possessive instead of a plural possessive apostrophe, that's wrong. But when you do get into commas, that's when it gets more interesting in a way, but it is certainly very hard to lay down hard and fast rules. You can imagine what the editing of this book was like. The process was one of the most painful experiences I've ever had. Because even though clearly the book was about my opinions on punctuation, my editor had different opinions on punctuation, so we had to compromise a few times.
That's really funny, though. I mean, because after all, the book is supposed to be about your opinions on punctuation, so those must have been interesting little skirmishes.
Oh, I was very discouraged. After a while, I thought, oh, I know nothing. But I had two different editors who, of course, had contradictory ideas, too. So having reluctantly accepted one editor's ideas, I would then have them challenged by the next editor who supported what I'd done in the first place, unknowingly. So it just goes to show that I know that people do want hard and fast rules, and there are hard and fast rules about, as I say, about apostrophes. But I do think in a lot of other cases, it's better to use your common sense than to use your ear. And to, you know, just listen and think about what the meaning is if you put that comma in or if you leave it out.
As you say in your book, some people use a lot of semicolons. Some people really are not fans of the semicolon. Some people like to use dashes. Other people are not fans of dashes. Where would you place yourself on the scale?
I suppose I do err on the side of the dash, probably. But I love semicolons. I think they do. The analogy I draw in the book is that semicolons and colons just give you this, it's as though you're sort of floating on air in a sentence, and a semicolon and a colon just waft you up again. You know, you get another wonderful thermal, you know, takes you along. And I think they're terribly elegant and marvellous marks. And I think a dash doesn't do that. A dash is much more prosaic, down-to-earth kind of mark, as far as I'm concerned. It doesn't promise anything, a dash. You know, you start, you know, you've heard one part of a sentence, you get a dash, you have another part of the sentence. And it could be related to what went before, but it might not be. It might be completely unrelated. Semicolons, when you have a semicolon, that is a promise. There is a promise involved in the semicolon that what you're reading next will be related to what you've had before. And a colon is a real firm promise it's going to explain what went before. It's going to illuminate what went before. And I didn't really quite understand about colons, I think, before I worked on the book. And I now think they're quite marvellous. I use an example in the book, which anyone who knows anything about English football or soccer will, I hope, appreciate. It's to demonstrate the difference between colons and semicolons. So without either, you have Tom locked himself in the shed, period. England lost to Argentina, period, which is just two statements that you know, that's all. They happened in the past. That's all you probably know about that. Then if you say Tom locked himself in the shed, semicolon, England lost to Argentina, that's, you know, that suggests that there is some connection between these two events, but they're both in the past. But it could be that, you know, Tom locked himself in the shed, England lost to Argentina, the rabbit electrocuted itself by biting into the power cable of the washing machine. Then you have, with the colon, Tom locked himself in the shed, colon, England lost to Argentina. And then, you know, Tom locked himself in the shed because England lost to Argentina. So I think if you can sort of handle that, it really helps. You can do more subtle things, really, with writing if you only ever use periods, or as we call them, full stops. You really can't, you can't suggest connections between thoughts, which, you know, that's mainly what you want to do when you're writing.
Let me ask you to explain the title of your book, Eats, Shoots and Leaves.
Well, it's a joke that someone told me while we were making the Cutting a Dash programs, and it's a joke about a panda who goes into a bar and he orders a sandwich and he eats a sandwich. And then just as he's about to go, he gets a gun out and he fires the gun. And they say, why? You know, why are you behaving like this? Pandas don't behave like this. And he shows them a wildlife manual with and his entry. And it says, panda, large black and white bear-like mammal, native to China, eats, comma, shoots and leaves. So obviously, normally a panda eats, shoots and leaves. But if you put the comma in, he behaves in a very un-panda-like fashion.
Yeah, that's a great story. How did you learn punctuation? Did you learn punctuation in school, or you know, did you kind of figure it out more independently?
I think when it really came together for me was when I first left university. I started work as a sub-editor on magazines and newspapers, and I think that's when it fell into place for me. I think I knew what all the marks were when I was at school. And I think I was always corrected. I think we were always, even if we weren't taught it particularly, I do remember that our, you know, certainly if I put an apostrophe and it's in the wrong place, that would be crossed out until I got it right, which I think is something that isn't really done anymore. So, but I think it was really when you're sitting down to edit something written by a professor of history at Cambridge or something, that you feel, oh, I really ought to know what I'm doing here about subordinate clauses and so on. Actually, the story about Thurber, I remember the Thurber and Ross stuff, reading the years with Ross when I was a very young editor. I remember being at my desk and reading that story and telling everybody about this marvellous story about Ross needing a comma in after dinner. The men went into the drawing room. You have to have a comma after dinner because it gives the men time to stand up and push back their chairs, which is such a great story. And I remember finding that when I was about 22 years old and reading it to everybody because I thought it was just so charming.
Lynn Truss, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much. It was lovely.
Lynn Truss is the author of Eats, Shoots and Leaves, The Zero Tolerance Approach to Punctuation.